Well, you don't want to get too close to poetry. It might rub off on you. Never know. As I said, my name is Jack Ledbetter. I'm from Southern California, and I do poems and other things. And this session is just some of my favorite poems, just kind of at general, at random. And I have a bunch of them, so after a while, if you want to recommend one or say I'd like to hear this or that, I'll see if I can dig it out from these tomes. I don't have them all, but... I once asked the American poet Mark Van Doren which of his own poems he liked best, and he says he wrote back and said, "Be serious." You see where that line comes from in the play there?
Are those all written by you?
Oh, no. I won't read any of mine tonight, today. No, thanks.
I've seen them.
Oh, thank you. Some of the ones I've written are among my favorites, but I usually don't have the courage to sneak one of mine in on this kind of a session because there's so many great poets lurking about. That I usually kind of like to read this. I'm going to start off with one by Longfellow and just to kind of get things rolling. It's called The Day Is Done. It isn't quite, but it's one of my favorite poems. I hope you like Longfellow. The day is done and the darkness falls from the wings of night as a feather is wafted downward from an eagle in his flight. I see the lights of the village gleam through the rain and the mist, and a feeling of sadness comes o'er me that my soul cannot resist. A feeling of sadness and longing that is not akin to pain, and resembles sorrow only as the mist resembles the rain. Come read to me some poem, some simple and heartfelt lay, that shall soothe this restless feeling and banish the thoughts of day. Not from the grand old masters, not from the bard sublime, whose distant footsteps echo through the corridors of time. For like strains of martial music, their mighty thoughts suggest life's endless toil and endeavor, and tonight I long for rest. Read from some humbler poet, whose songs gushed from his heart as showers from the clouds of summer or tears from the eyelids start, who through long days of labor and nights devoid of ease still heard in his soul the music of wonderful melodies. Such songs have power to quiet the restless pulse of care and come like the benediction that follows after prayer. Then read from the treasured volume the poem of thy choice and lend to the rhyme of the poet the beauty of thy voice. And the night shall be filled with music and the cares that infest the day shall fold their tents like the Arabs and silently steal away. Now that's not bad writing. Too often, I think, in graduate classes in English, anyway, a lot of profs, it's sort of in to look down on Longfellow as if he had his day and then has nothing more worth hearing, which is garbage. Longfellow's an excellent poet, will always be an excellent poet. Once you're good in any time, you're good for all times. It's sometimes everything's cyclical. And it takes us various times we decide somebody is good, like we've discovered him. Like the 17th century poets were so discovered by T.S. Eliot. That's funny. But that's the way it happens. Well, here's a poem that I don't know if it's my favorite or not. I just came across it. I won't even give you the title. See if you can pick this one out. But this first line doesn't do it. By the rude bridge that arched the flood, their flag to April's breeze unfurled. Here once the embattled farmer stood and fired the shot heard round the world. The foe long since in silence slept, alike the conqueror silent sleeps. And time the ruined bridge has swept down the dark stream which seaward creeps. On this green bank by this soft stream we set today a votive stone. That memory may their deed redeem when like our sires our sons are gone. Spirit that made those heroes dare to die and leave their children free, bid time and nature gently spare the shaft we raise to them and thee. Conquered him, right? You recognize that one.
Do you remember the words, but I don't remember the name.
Yeah, meet Conquered Him by Ralph Waldo Emerson, another very fine poet, one of the best minds of any time, of any day. Emerson had that great gift of saying, not only being able to write fine poetry, but his essays are among the best anywhere. And every now and then he could say something that just kind of gets under your skin, like, he who would be a man must first be a nonconformist. That's one of those things that riles people sometimes. Say, what do you mean by nonconformist? Then you're off and running and debating it. Well, he's out fishing. He's already said it. Or another one by Emerson, nothing is at last sacred but the integrity of your own mind. That riles people sometimes too. Here's another poem I like. See if you can remember this. Who wrote this? It's called To Helen. Any Helens in here? That's why I read it anyway. Helen, thy beauty is to me like those Nicaean barks of yore that gently o'er a perfumed sea the weary, way-worn wanderer bore to his own native shore. On desperate seas long wont to roam, thy hyacinth hair, thy classic face, thy naiad airs have brought me home to the glory that was Greece and the grandeur that was Rome. Lo, in yon brilliant window niche, how statue-like I see thee stand, the agate lamp within thy hand. Ah, Psyche, from the regions which are holy land. Does that ring any bells? That's Edgar Allan Poe. One of his rare moods when he wasn't trying to frighten everybody with ghouls and gory worms. Very fine Poe poem, isn't it? Well, let's see here. I read some Frost the other day. I guess I could read another one, couldn't I? I'll read it again. The Road Not Taken. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other, as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim, because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day. Yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere, ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. That's a good poem, too. I guess they don't make them any better than Robert Frost, do they? Of a poet or a poem? Or both? Did you say a poet or a poem?
No.
Yeah, that's a fair question. In one respect, I think if you resonate with what the person is saying, if it touches some strings in your psyche, then for you, that poem or that poet is worthwhile. And it doesn't matter whether centuries of criticism has agreed or disagreed. On the other hand, if somebody like Shakespeare or Chaucer or Wordsworth or whoever has lasted so many years, like composers, like artists, Bach, Handel, Brahms, there must be something to it. Occasionally I teach criticism where I teach, and not very often because I don't like criticism very much, but once in a while, just to keep my fingers in, I stab at it. And I have a hard time. There's something I tell my students. If you read a poem, and we read one in class, and they look at me and say, what does it mean? And I don't often say what I think. I say, what do you think it means? And it's amazing how inept they feel they are to respond to that. I say, well, just give me a gut reaction. You like it or you don't like it. And then we can go from there. And they'll say, well, this is what I think it means. I say, that's fair enough. If you think it means that, then can you tell me why you think it means it? And if you can, I'm happy. I won't change it. On the other hand, now that you've told me that, and now that I know why you think it means what it does, let me tell you what the last 400 years of scholarship says about it. That may or may not change your mind. If it doesn't change your mind, beautiful. You can say, I don't care what 400 years of scholarship says. I say it means this. I'll stand behind you. But it's sometimes pig-headed of a student not to look at 400 years of scholarship, too. People must have known something.
Yeah, sure.
So we kind of work our way through like that, and what the scholars say, what their innards say.
I think a choice of word makes a lot of difference, because two people can say the same thing, mm-hmm. and one is poetry and the other isn't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. true enough. If it moves, you, it's doing what it's supposed to do. And not every poem or every piece of music moves, right? Bartok moves me in a different way than Brahms, for example, or not as much, but that says nothing about Bartok. It says probably more about my background, my preference for romantic music as opposed to something more dissonant, maybe, or something like that. It's a good question, getting the problem of aesthetics, what is beauty and all that kind of thing. Keats, of course, summed that up better than anybody, and when somebody says, what is beauty? He says, beauty? Beauty is truth. Truth is beauty. That's all you know on earth, and all you need to know. Well, that's fine, but Keats could just shuffle off and leave us with those lines and wondering, what does that mean, Keats? What do you mean truth is beauty? Yeah, beauty is truth. That's a circular argument, circular definition. But
is that necessarily what he was saying, though, in that poem? I also thought that maybe that was what the urn was saying, and that he left it up to, he didn't really say that was what he thought.
Oh, I see. Yeah, that's fair enough. Using the urn as a persona, as a mask, sure. I don't know whether that's what he was saying or not. You may be right. Tree at my window, interesting Frost poem, which I didn't read the other day. Tree at my window tree, my sash is lowered when night comes on, but let there never be curtain drawn between you and me. Vague dream head lifted out of the ground, and thing next most diffused to cloud, not all your light tongues talking aloud could be profound. But tree, I have seen you taken and tossed, and if you have seen me when I slept, you have seen me when I was taken and swept and all but lost. That day she put our heads together, fate had her imagination about her. Your head so much connected with outer, mine with inner weather. W.H. Auden, do you know Auden at all? A-U-D-E-N. He's a good man. I think he's recently died, I'm not sure. I think he did. He was an English poet, came to America a lot. We kind of traded T.S. Eliot for Auden. Eliot was a St. Louis person and went to England, and Auden was English and came here. I don't know who got the better of the deal. Depends whether you like Auden or T.S. Eliot. There's a poem called The Unknown Citizen, and then subtitled to JS/07/M/378, this marble monument is erected by the state. He was found by the Bureau of Statistics to be one against whom there was no official complaint, and all the reports on his conduct agree that in the modern sense of an old-fashioned word, he was a saint. For in everything he did, he served the greater community. Except for the war, till the day he retired, he worked in a factory and never got fired, but satisfied his employers, Fudge Motors, Inc. Yet he wasn't a scab or odd in his views, for his union reports that he paid his dues. Our report on his union shows it was sound. And our social psychology workers found that he was popular with his mates and liked to drink. The press are convinced that he bought a paper every day and that his reactions to advertisements were normal in every way. Policies taken out in his name prove that he was fully insured, and his health card shows that he was once in hospital but left it cured. Both producers' research and high-grade living declare he was fully sensible to the advantages of the installment plan and had everything necessary to the modern man. A stereo, a radio, a car, and a Frigidaire. Our researchers into public opinion are content that he held the proper opinion for the time of year. When there was peace, he was for peace. When there was war, he went. He was married and added 5 children to the population, which our eugenist says was the right number for a parent of his generation. And our teachers report that he never interfered with their education. Was he free? Was he happy? The question is absurd. Had anything been wrong, we should certainly have heard.
When?
No. Oh, early on.
I already thought he was British when he made that statement. I didn't realize he was born in the States.
Yes, born in St. Louis, and his father was a well-to-do, owned a big brick, kind of a quarry brick company. And he was raised quite a bit in Massachusetts, did a lot of sailing. And then went to Harvard for about 3 and 3.5 years and wrote a dissertation that nobody could grade, so he walked off without his degree. Yeah, nobody could understand. He actually was born on Berkeley, philosopher, but so he didn't take the degree, but he's a smart cookie. I ought to read some T.S. Eliot sometime, but I didn't bring you right now. Well, T.S. Eliot's not the kind of poet you just sit down and just and casually toss off a T.S. He's just not casual. I'm looking for William Carlos Williams was a New Jersey obstetrician, delivered several hundred babies, and wrote some really fine poems. And one in particular has always been one of my favorite poems, called The Red Wheelbarrow. And I usually like to start off a class in criticism with this one. I tell the students to get ready. I want them to write volumes on this one. And they do. And this is it. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. That's it. You ready for stanza two?
Read it again.
All right.
Didn't even get it.
Neither did my students. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens.
Excuse me, was that glazed?
Or yes.
Glazed?
No, glazed. So glazed.
Chickens.
That's 4 days of hiking, you get a little. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. Yeah. And that's it. And sometimes students say, well, what's so big about that? Well, that's like saying, what's so big about blueberries or love or babies or anything else? It says it is what it is. It's like Frost's poem, The Pasture, if I can remember it. That's what that's why the red wheelbarrow's there, I guess. But he just came home one night early, 6 in the morning, after delivering Mrs. McGillicuddy's twins, and Dr. Williams was leaning up against his barn and puffing on his pipe or having a last cigarette before going in the house. He'd been up all night, and his wife and the daughter were asleep in the farmhouse, and it had rained that night, and he had his chickens were out there clucking and scratching around, and the little red wheelbarrow had filled up with some water, and he thought, gee, that's a nice sight, and just said so, and that's the way he said it. And that's all there is to it. There's no heavy symbols, nothing going on there that needs explanation.
Would you be the author again?
That was William Carlos Williams.
But sometimes, isn't it, this, if I had written it, nobody knows me, it would be trivia.
If you had written exactly that? If you had written exactly those words, it would have been a brilliant little thing, no matter who you were, I think. I don't think it's good because I know Williams did it. I think it's good because it's just good by itself, I think.
It's a clear picture.
Yeah, it's a clear picture. Frost, The Pasture goes something, it's similar, if I can remember it like this. I'm going out to clear the pasture spring. I'll stop and rake the leaves away, I may. I'll stop to watch the water clear, I may. I shan't be gone long. You come too. I'm going out to fetch the little calf that's standing by her mother. It's so young, it totters when she licks it with her tongue. I shan't be gone long. You come too. That's that. You need poems to kind of balance T.S. Eliot. You need a few like that. Here's one called Danse Russe by Williams, Russian Dance. If when my wife is sleeping and the baby and Kathleen are sleeping and the sun is a flame white disk in silken mists above shining trees, if I in my north room dance naked grotesquely before my mirror, waving my shirt round my head and singing softly to myself, I am lonely, lonely, I was born to be lonely, I am best so. If I admire my arms, my face, my shoulders, flanks, buttocks against the yellow drawn shades, who shall say I am not the happy genius of my household? I just came across a line. He wrote a very, very long poem called Patterson about New Jersey. And I'm not going to read that, but I have one line in red. It said, minds like beds, always made up. I don't know where that comes from or goes, but it's caught my attention at one time. Not my head. Here's one by A.E. Housman, fine English poet. I rewrote this about 1895 or so. called Loveliest of Trees. Loveliest of trees, the cherry now is hung with bloom along the bough, and stands about the woodland ride wearing white for Eastertide. Now of my 80 years and 10, 20 will not come again, and take from 70 springs a score, it leaves me 50 more. And since to look at things in bloom, 50 springs are little room, about the woodlands I will go to see the cherry hung with snow.
What's the name of the collection that you have there?
This is called Chief Modern Poets of Britain and America, this particular one. This paperback is very fine. I think it may be in the bookstores. A Pocketbook of Modern Verse, edited by Oscar Williams. And this one is Major American Poets, by again, edited by Oscar Williams. Both of them are very fine. This is the one I teach from at school. The students sarcastically refer to as the Bible.
What is that?
This is Chief Modern Poets of Britain and America. It's Macmillan.
They don't have Eliot in there?
No, they don't. As a matter of fact, there's a little somewhere in here. I'm glad you mentioned that. I ought to read that if I can find it. You know, in the front of the book where it gives acknowledgments, they've taken this person's poem from here and this somebody else. Okay, special note from the editors. The reader of this volume will undoubtedly wonder why certain poets such as T.S. Eliot and a couple others are not quoted or mentioned, are not represented in this anthology. Harcourt, Brace, and World will not allow the use of Mr. Eliot's poems in paperback anthologies selling for less than $2.50. We must make a buck. Can you believe that? So you want a poet to be well known, and the best way to do it is to leave him out of the anthologies, I suppose. I don't understand that.
I was surprised to find in the bookstore the other day, when I was teaching school, I used to use the 101 famous poems,
mm-hmm.
and I went in and asked him, and they had it.
Sure, I have that one too.
That is a beautiful.
Yeah, they keep that I think going pretty much. That's a fine collection of poems. Got some good poems.
But it doesn't have that one of Longfellow's that you just read.
It probably has a couple others by Longfellow.
It has a couple of others,
yeah.
But it doesn't have Noah Spikesmith either.
I think it has Hiawatha in there. And,
yes, Hiawatha
yeah,
is in there.
Yeah.
Children's Hour.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Here's a very soothing kind of a poem called Piano. And I want to read it to you, then I want to surprise you by telling you who wrote it. Some of you will be surprised, some won't. Softly in the dusk, a woman is singing to me, taking me back down the vista of years, till I see a child sitting under the piano in the boom of the tingling strings, and pressing the small, poised feet of a mother who smiles as she sings. In spite of myself, the insidious mastery of song betrays me back, till the heart of me weeps to belong to the old Sunday evenings at home, with winter outside and hymns in the cozy parlor, the tinkling piano our guide. So now it is vain for the singer to burst into clamor with a great black piano appassionato. The glamour of childish days is upon me. My manhood is cast down in the flood of remembrance. I weep like a child for the past. That sort of sounds like Longfellow, except it doesn't have Longfellow rhythm, but that's D.H. Lawrence. And people who have kind of grown up with women in love and sons and lovers sometimes are surprised to find that he could be so quiet. D.H. Lawrence, in my opinion, is maybe the most complete writer that I know about. I don't know anybody who is so good at writing poems and novels and short stories. D.H. Lawrence could do it all, I think. The fact that two or three of his novels were banned and all that kind of thing, I just, in some ways, proves that he was great. But yeah, that's a silly thing to say. A lot of people have been banned, right? Swinburne was banned in England, and Walt Whitman was banned, and Henry Miller was banned. Tropic of Cancer, Tropic of Capricorn, couldn't buy those, had to buy the Tijuana in a plain brown wrapper. Now you can buy anything in revolving racks in any drugstore for 95 cents. The sign of the times.
Except
T.S. Eliot. $2.50, yeah. Oh, I know what I wanted to read. How about Gerard Manley Hopkins? Want to hear a Hopkins? I'm going to talk about him tomorrow, I think. But just happened to come by here. God's Grandeur. Oh, Pied Beauty. I want to read Pied Beauty. You know what Pied means? Anybody, printers in here?
You know, what's the word?
Pied, P-I-E-D, jumbled, mixed. The printer's devil, the apprentice to the printer sometimes would knock over his tray and it's pied type. I did, when I was in high school, we still had a print our own print shop, and I did that regularly. And I'd have to get down and pick those little things up with tweezers, and they're upside down and backwards, you know, and you have to, and you drop thousands of them, and I'd be down on my hand. I spent 4 years on my hands and knees picking those things up. Pied Beauty. This is interesting poem. It seems to me we live in a kind of a generation or an age of Tupperware, and everybody has to be young and pretty and beautiful and slim and blonde and smell good. And if you don't, it's too bad. Well, nuts to that philosophy, and Hopkins said it better than I did. Glory be to God for dappled things, for skies of couple color as a brinded cow, for rose moles all in stipple upon trout that swim, fresh fire coal, chestnut falls, finches' wings, landscape plotted and pieced, fold, fallow, and plow, and all trades, their gear and tackle and trim, all things counter, original, spare, strange, whatever is fickle, freckled, who knows how, with swift, slow, sweet, sour, a dazzle dim, he fathers forth whose beauty is past change. Praise him. That's more like it. Now, I know I was going to read you an Edna St. Vincent Millay. How would you like it? Do you like Millay? As one of my profs used to say, we don't read her anymore. I say, oh, don't we? We do now. It's like when the same silly comment when Henry David Thoreau came out one day from his cabin. He was making his Walden Pond experiment, and he wandered into town and thought he needed a new coat. He'd patched his coat up about as much as it was all patches. And he walked into this little store and said, I'd like a coat, so-and-so style. And the person behind the counter says, oh, they're not wearing them anymore like that. He says, oh, they aren't. Well, they are now. I love that comment. I like Henry David Thoreau anyway. But you know what it is to be out of fashion. Have someone tell you they aren't wearing them that way. Well, what would you like to hear by Edna St. Vincent Millay? How about Love is Not All, It Is Not Meat Nor Drink? Can you buy into that philosophy?
Seriously?
Seriously. Ah, Paul. See what you think of this, Paul. Love is not all. It is not meat, nor drink, nor slumber, nor a roof against the rain, nor yet a floating spar to men that sink and rise and sink and rise and sink again. Love cannot fill the thickened lung with breath, nor clean the bone, nor set the fractured, nor clean the blood, nor set the fractured bone. Yet many a man is making friends with death, even as I speak, for lack of love alone. It well may be that in a difficult hour, pinned down by pain and moaning for release, or nagged by want past resolution's power, I might be driven to sell your love for peace, or trade the memory of this night for food. It well may be, I do not think I would. Edna St. Vincent Millay is a fine poet, isn't she? Listen to this one. I thought that was good. This is a great title, too. What lips my lips have kissed, and where and why. It sounds like you're going to get a dissertation on. But all we get is a sonnet, thank goodness. What lips my lips have kissed, and where and why, I have forgotten. And what arms have lain under my head till morning. But the rain is full of ghosts tonight, that tap and sigh upon the glass and listen for reply. And in my heart there stirs a quiet pain for unremembered lads that not again will turn to me at midnight with a cry. Thus in the winter stands the lonely tree, nor knows what birds have vanished one by one, yet knows its boughs more silent than before. I cannot say what loves have come and gone. I only know that summer sang in me a little while that in me sings no more. Now nobody writes that well anymore. See, we put Edna St. Vincent Millay and Longfellow together, and graduate English profs say, well, we don't read them anymore. I once, one of the same profs that said that to me, I once made the mistake of showing him one of my poems, and it rhymed. And he, in the same haughty, pontifical tone, informed me that it's not done anymore. One does not rhyme anymore. I said, oh, this one does. Wrong thing to say to that guy. Edna St. Vincent Millay was, you don't care about that, something to think. I was going to get into these biographical nuggets, but I should just, I want to read this poem called Dirge Without Music by Millay. This is really interesting. I am not resigned to the shutting away of loving hearts in the hard ground. So it is, and so it will be, for so it has been, time out of mind. Into the darkness they go, the wise and the lovely. Crowned with lilies and with laurel they go, but I am not resigned. Lovers and thinkers, into the earth with you. Be one with the dull, the indiscriminate dust. A fragment of what you felt, of what you knew, a formula, a phrase remains, and the best is lost. The answer is quick and keen. The honest look, the laughter, the love, they are gone. They are gone to feed the roses, elegant and curled as the blossom, fragrant as the blossom. I know, but I do not approve. More precious was the light in your eyes than all the roses in the world. Down, down, down into the darkness of the grave, gently they go, the beautiful, the tender, the kind. Quietly they go, the intelligent, the witty, the brave. I know, but I do not approve, and I am not resigned.
There's a poem by Denise Levertov, Goodbye to Tolerance. You read that?
No. Similar?
Yeah.
She's very good, too. A lot of good women poets around. If they, two or three, they keep killing themselves.
Yeah.
That's not funny. Why did I laugh at that? Anne Sexton, Sylvia Plath. Confessional poetry, John Berryman. When you write confessional poetry, when you pour your heart out, sometimes you reach the end. There's nothing else you can confess, and then there's nothing left but to pull the plug. Very often, it's just vital to remember to be objective somehow in poetry, and that's the hardest thing for students, I think, sometimes to learn, is to objectify their subjective experience. Give it something that we can all buy into and say, yeah, I remember I did that, or that affects me some way. To be completely subjective is to eventually wind up with nothing to say, because we all have our own pain. We all have our own set of sorrows and memories, right? So if I just bleed all over the page, what can you do with it? Say, well, I'm sorry for your troubles, but you have to, as T.S. Eliot, again, finding the objective correlative, what correlates objectively to my experience so I can kind of bring you into it. That's the hardest thing. That and knowing when to quit. When to quit writing. I once wrote a brilliant poem about a snake. I saw a little green water snake down in one of the arroyos in Southern California where I live, and I went back and I dashed off this brilliant poem, sent it to Mark Van Doren, and he wrote back, as he was always kind enough to do, and he had drawn a line. The last 12 lines were just, he said, the poem ends here. I wrote back and said, Mark, you've made a horrible mistake. I said, the last 12 lines are the best. I shouldn't have said that to Mark Van Doren. He wrote back and he said, well, who the hell am I to criticize? He said, you keep the last 12 lines, but I won't read it. So I took a long look at it again, and the last 12 lines brought me into the poem, my reaction to the snake. The first part of the poem was just about the snake, and he was right, as usual. It was the snake I was talking about, not my reaction to the snake. That's a very, very tough lesson to learn, too, because you're determined to get yourself in there somehow. Archibald MacLeish is a poet you may remember, born in 1892 and is still alive, I think. Had an interesting political career, too. He was undersecretary to Roosevelt and a couple of other, at least one other president. and managed to be a poet. You can do other things and be poets, can't you? Most of the time you eat lots better, yeah. William Carlos Williams, a physician. Richard Eberhardt, very, very fine contemporary poet who lives in New Hampshire, has a wax company and teaches at the University of New Hampshire. What are some other professions? Can you think of any that the poets have had? It's suddenly occurred to me that's an interesting topic. I don't know why. Maybe it's not. What else can one do besides write?
Teach.
Yeah. That's right. This is Ars Poetica, Poetic Arts by MacLeish. A poem should be palpable and mute as a globed fruit, dumb as old medallions to the thumb, silent as the sleeve-worn stone of casement ledges where the moss has grown. A poem should be wordless as the flight of birds. A poem should be motionless in time as the moon climbs, leaving as the moon releases twig by twig the night-entangled trees, leaving as the moon behind the winter leaves, memory by memory, the mind. A poem should be motionless in time as the moon climbs. A poem should be equal to, not true, for all the history of grief, an empty doorway and a maple leaf, for love, the leaning grasses and two lights above the sea. A poem should not mean. Now, do you have any poem you'd like to... How about a little Evangelum? I mentioned that the other day as being the first poem that I ever read in the 7th grade. Evangelum by Longfellow. And I never read it, but I'll just read parts of it. This is the forest primeval, the murmuring pines and the hemlocks, bearded with moss and in garments green, indistinct in the twilight. Stand like druids of eld with voices sad and prophetic. Stand like harpers hoar with beards that rest on their bosoms. Loud from its rocky caverns, the deep-voiced neighboring ocean speaks, and in accents disconsolate answers the wail of the forest. This is the forest primeval. But where are the hearts that beneath it leap like the roe when he hears in the woodland the voice of the huntsman? Where is the thatch-roofed village, the home of Acadian farmers, men whose lives glided on like rivers that water the woodlands, darkened by shadows of earth, but reflecting an image of heaven? Waste are those pleasant farms, and the farmers forever departed, scattered like dust and leaves when the mighty blasts of October seize them and whirl them aloft and sprinkle them far over the ocean. Ye who believe in affection that hopes and endures and is patient, ye who believes in the beauty and strength of woman's devotion, list to the mournful tradition still sung by the pines of the forest. List to a tale of love in Acadia, home of the happy. That's nice, huh? When you're camping at that, anywhere around here, you know what the forest primeval is all about. So last night at Lyman Lake, I wasn't thinking about forest primeval. I was thinking my feet. My sore feet. I go up there to be poetic, and all I can do is moan and groan about my sore feet. Let me read two lines. This is $64 if you get this one. I'll have somebody else pay you. Should you ask me whence these stories, whence these legends and traditions? What's that from? Hiawatha. With the odors of the forest, with the dew and damp of meadows, with the curling smoke of wigwams, with the rushing of great rivers, with their frequent repetitions and their wild reverberations as of thunder in the mountains. I should answer, I should tell you, from the forests and the prairies, from the great lakes of the Northland, et cetera, et cetera. Go on and on and on.
And
that, I can't remember the finish line. Do you remember that? No. It's real good, man. Mm-hmm. Do you have anything to have down? Is that Anapopsis? I bet I don't. Rats. That's an awfully good poem, too, isn't it? That's a very fine poem. No, I can't recite it either.
Who's it by?
Oh, Bryant. William Cullen Bryant. Excellent poem. Well, would you settle for William Butler Yeats?
Yeah.
That's close. Yeats is Irish. This is a nice poem called When You Are Old, which I've always admired. When you are old and gray and full of sleep and nodding by the fire, take down this book and slowly read and dream of the soft look your eyes had once and of their shadows deep. How many loved your moments of glad grace and loved your beauty with love false or true? But one man loved the pilgrim soul in you and loved the sorrows of your changing face. And bending down beside the glowing bars, murmur a little sadly how love fled and paced upon the mountains overhead and hid his face amid a crowd of stars. Isn't that nice? What time do you have?
It's about 4:44.
Is dinner still at 5 and 6, or are we down to 1?
5 and 6.
Okay. Here's another, Yeats. Every time I read this poem, I think of it. For me, it was kind of an amusing thing happened. I'll read you the poem and tell you about it. It's called The Lake Isle of Innisfree. It's a fine Irish poem. I will rise and go now and go to Innisfree, and a small cabin build there of clay and wattles made. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honeybee, and live alone in the bee-loud glade. And I shall have some peace there, for peace comes dropping slow, dropping from the veils of the morning to where the cricket sings. There midnight's all a glimmer, and noon a purple glow, and evening full of the linnet's wings. I will arise and go now, for always night and day I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore. While I stand on the roadway or on the pavements gray, I hear it in the deep heart's core. That's nice, isn't it? I remember one time I was teaching this poem in class, and there was this one fellow, Neanderthal type, in the back, and he had this glazed look in his eye. And after class, he came up and he said, "I don't get it." And he said that every day, no matter what I said, he said, same response, "I don't get it." So I was determined that we were going to work this one through this time. So everybody went out, and I said, sit down, and I got eyeball to eyeball, and I read this poem. I will arise and go now and go to Innisfree in a small cabin built, and he stopped me. He says, "How small?" I said, "I don't know, big one bedroom, it doesn't matter." He said, "What do you mean it doesn't matter?" I said, "All right." He was very literal. I said, "All right, it matters, one bedroom. Of clay and wattles." Anyone know about clay and wattles? 9 bean rows will I have there. And he said, stop. He said, "Why 9 beans? 9 bean rows. Why not just 9? And a hive for the honeybee." And that really, he said, you mean you got one bee? I said, "No, never mind." I said, I knew we were in trouble. "And live alone in the bee-loud glade." And he kind of put his hand up here, and he said, I see it. I said, "Good, good." I coaxed him through. Yeah. That was funny. You want to know why anybody would want 9 bean rows, and why would you go to the trouble to have a hive for one bee? He thought that was kind of silly, but we worked our way through that. I was almost ready to give up teaching or poetry or both at that point.
As long as you're on Yeats, do you want to read Second Coming?
Yes, it is. I certainly will, since you asked. I'll preface it by saying, since I'm going to read it, since we're not getting to T.S. Eliot, the next hardest would be this poem. Let me see, Second Coming. This poem has probably had more essays written about it than next to Keats' Ode on a Grecian Urn, which I think is fairly easy to get at. This one, well, I'll just read it. It's called The Second Coming. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming. Hardly are those words out when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight. Somewhere in sands of the desert, a shape with lion body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow thighs, while all about it reel shadows of the indignant desert birds. The darkness drops again, but now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born. That is a powerful poem.
And that has been argued and argued and argued. What is it that's... Let me read those last few lines. The darkness drops again, but now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born. Oh, that's good. I should know that. I'll have to look it up. mentioning the clock and things like just as popped something else in my mind. Yeats' poem called "The Circus Animal's Desertion," which I don't have here, but it reminded me of that because the circus animals in this poem are Yeats's ideas. And as he grew older, he realized he was having less and less ideas about which to write poems. So he said in the last two lines, his ladder, you know, that he used to climb up to find inspiration, we'll say. He said, "I'll put my ladder where all ladders start, in the foul rag and bone shop of the heart." I don't know why clock reminded me of that, so it's who cares, right? But I think it's a great line, no matter why. The foul rag and bone shop of the heart. I've always liked that. I bet you like it too, don't you? Okay, Sandberg, Chicago. Hog butcher for the world, tool maker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads and the nation's freight handler, stormy, husky, brawling, city of the big shoulders. They tell me you are wicked, and I believe them, for I have seen your painted women under the gas lamps luring the farm boys. And they tell me you are crooked, and I answer, yes, it is true. I have seen the gunman kill and go free to kill again. And they tell me you are brutal, and my reply is, on the faces of women and children, I have seen the marks of wanton hunger. And having answered so, I turn once more to those who sneer at this, my city, and I give them back the sneer and say to them, come and show me another city with lifted head singing so proud to be alive and coarse and strong and cunning, flinging magnetic curses amid the toil of piling job on job. Here is a tall, bold slugger set vivid against the little soft cities, fierce as a dog with tongue lapping for action, cunning as a savage pitted against the wilderness, bareheaded, shoveling, wrecking, planning, building, breaking, rebuilding. Under the smoke, dust all over his mouth, laughing with white teeth under the terrible burden of destiny, laughing as a young man laughs, laughing even as an ignorant fighter laughs who has never lost a battle, bragging and laughing that under his wrist is the pulse and under his ribs the heart of the people. Laughing, laughing, the stormy, husky, brawling laughter of youth, half-naked, sweating, proud to be hog butcher, tool maker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads, and freight handler to the nation. I'll dedicate that to Mayor Daley. All right, I want to close then with this one. This is you got me on Sandberg. It's called Prayers of Steel, which is one of my favorite Sandberg poems. Lay me on an anvil, O God. Beat me and hammer me into a crowbar. Let me pry loose old walls. Let me lift and loosen old foundations. Lay me on an anvil, O God. Beat me and hammer me into a steel spike. Drive me into girders that hold a skyscraper together. Take red-hot rivets and fasten me into the central girders. Let me be the great nail holding a skyscraper through blue nights into white stars. You don't find many poets that celebrate cities, you know. Most poets are supposed to be anti-cities, aren't they? And Carl Sandburg was the exception. Of course, he was living on his hog farm in North Carolina when he wrote that. So. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you.